the matter of Club Vista Financial Services versus the District Court, case 57784. This matter is set for 10 a.m. Before we begin with arguments, I believe it is appropriate for me to make a disclosure, and that is that a former law clerk of mine is now employed by the Markey and Arbach firm. It does not, however, in any way affect my ability to be impartial, at least from my perspective. If anyone has any concerns about my ability to sit in this matter, I will tell you that this case was already in the Supreme Court long before Mr. Clement became a member of this firm. So he certainly from this side of the V, if you will, he has had nothing to do with this matter. Is there anyone who wishes to be heard?
Just for the record, the Scott defendants have no objection. Scott respondents have no objection.
Thank you.
Obviously, we have none, and I'll know that he turned down Mr. Jones to come to us.
Thank you very much. And with that, are the parties ready to proceed?
Yeah. Good morning. Terry Coffin, Markey Arbach Coffin, and Micah Eccles on behalf of the petitioners herein. Before we get to some of the substantive legal issues, I'd like to address at least briefly that this is a unique transaction, and I dare say differs in the characterization that's been put forth by my colleague. Specifically, Gary Tharaldson and his entities, Club Vista Financial and TM2I, are not the borrowers in this case. They merely serve as guarantors, although Club Vista Financial does have a small financial stake in this as a lender, and that creates a distinction between the parties and makes this transaction somewhat different than a normal transaction that you might consider these facts upon. Additionally, I want to emphasize that Mr. Tharaldson had a long time relationship of trust and confidence with one of the defendants, Brad Scott, and his company, Brad Scott Financial Corporation. And that's important when it comes to the facts of this case as to how Mr. Tharaldson executed these documents.
And but your fiduciary duty claims have been adjudicated against you as a matter of law. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. But Judge Denton has consistently stated that while there's no fiduciary duty here, he has characterized the relationship between Mr. Tharaldson and Mr. Scott as being a special relationship. Now, that is somewhat undefined and candidly of some question to everyone in this case. Those claims have been dismissed, but those that Judge Denton's very comments on that basis were the reasons why, at least from our perspective, he did not grant a summary judgment on the concealment and constructive fraud claims, at least as they relate to Brad Scott and Scott Financial. And as we go back, and I think the reason is because Judge Denton has obviously heard more than any other judge the motion practice in this case, and he realizes that the way this transaction came about, that is an appropriate distinction to make. Remember, Gary Tharaldson got a knock on the door, receives 9 inches of documents with arrows, sign here, sign here, sign here. And these were after a long negotiation, and he executes these documents, and within those documents are the jury waivers that I dare say form the real basis of what we're talking about here today. Because I cannot credibly stand before you and say that this court has somehow not recognized the validity of jury waivers in the Lowe case, and I won't do that. But I do think that Judge Denton erred in applying the Lowe factors and that he failed to consider all of those factors. In fact, I think Judge Denton's decision really harped upon the fact, as Mr. Jones is going to show you, that the waiver provision and the guarantees at issue were in bold and capitals directly above the signature blocks, and thus Mr. Tharaldson should not be able to avoid their effect now. But what that ignores and inherently contradicts, I believe, is Judge Denton's finding or failure to enter summary judgment on the claims despite the repeated requests of the Scott and Bank of Oklahoma claimants. He's held that there are issues of fact that must be adjudicated as to the validity of the guarantees. And we suggest that requires that those facts be put to a jury and the jury decide as to the validity of those guarantees and thus inherently the jury waivers contained therein.
So your argument is that the showing sufficient to escape summary judgment is sufficient to overcome the presumption in favor of the validity of the jury trial waiver. I see those as two distinct burdens, and the Lowe case says you have the burden of refuting the presumption that it was knowing, voluntary, and whatever the third factor is.
The four factors. You're correct in that, but we don't see them as being distinct, because if the proposition that I think you're posing is true, then my client's going to be forced to go to trial without a jury, and those facts that would otherwise may convince a jury to invalidate the guarantees will never be heard by a jury. So I understand this does set somewhat of a conundrum, but I think had the moving party been able to show sufficient facts to push Judge Denton over that edge, as it were, then you would be correct in your position. But to hold as you suggest would necessarily imply that my client's going to be denied the right to the jury on this critical issue of the validity of the guarantees. And that's why part of the reason why I want to make sure that this court understands he's not the borrower in this case. He is the guarantor. He wears three distinct hats in this case, but all of the operative facts relate to the validity of these guarantees, and obviously if he's able to avoid the guarantees, then this case changes dramatically from its current posture. The court also asked in its order setting hearing to address the validity of jury waivers themselves, and I'll start with the North Dakota law. I would suggest that the Century 20 case is cited by the opposition, although it is a recent case, it does not define North Dakota law as a federal case citing to federal law. And under North Dakota law, I think the cases we cited in Legion are clear that there is no presumptive waiver of a jury. There's no presumptive validity of a jury waiver that this court could rely upon. And thus, as it relates at least to the Bank of Oklahoma guarantee, those waivers, you cannot use the Lowe analysis. And I think that clearly provides for a case that the waivers are invalidated and we should be entitled to a jury on those issues. As for the status of the law here in Nevada, I understand that we have the Lowe case, but we also cited extensively from the Tuxedo Robinson case, in which this court made comment that it is not good policy for us to parse, and I'm obviously paraphrasing, parse out various provisions in a contract and say, well, these may be valid even in the face of a claim that the rest of the contract is invalid. And I suggest, while that is a departure from prior decisions, it makes logical sense because, as the court stated, it is inherently improbable that one portion of a contract can be subject to fraud, but the other portions cannot. And so to the extent that Robinson and the Tuxedo Robinson indicates this court's willingness to depart from that jurisprudence, I think that is the appropriate thing to do. So, if you boil this case down into its essence, my client has indeed been the subject of some unfavorable rulings in front of Judge Denton, but there remains triable issues of fact, and those facts need to be or deserve to be heard by a jury, as is my client's right under the Constitution.
So is it your position, carried to its extreme, that any time there's an allegation of fraud in the inducement of a contract, you must be able to get summary judgment on that fraud claim in order to escape the jury waiver in the contract, no matter how clear, how bold, how immediately above the signature, et cetera? Because that's exactly what I hear you saying. I don't know the test that would prevent that from being the result of your argument.
I appreciate the fact that the court is concerned that that would open up the ability to invalidate all types of agreement, but you need to look at the facts particular to this case. This case has been subject to dozens upon dozens of depositions, over a million pages of documentation, and by my count, at least 13 separate and distinct motions for summary judgment. And yet, those claims for concealment, constructive fraud survive. So I'm not suggesting the extreme that I think that you are, that just because you beat summary judgment, that you're going to go to trial on those things. But in the facts of this case certainly warrant that these claims have been tested on several occasions, and Judge Denton has consistently held the relationship between Scott Financial, Brad Scott, and Gary Tharlson necessarily mean that those issues need to be the subject of a trial, and that trial should be in front of a jury, as my client's rights are guaranteed under the Constitution, not only this state, but of North Dakota.
And if you were authoring an opinion on this, how would you articulate the test that salvages your right to jury trial in the face of the contractual waiver in this case, but prevents it from just being, oh, you automatically allege fraud in the inducement and you get by it?
Well, I think there has to be more than a prima facie showing, and I think that that's the case here. And certainly I'd agree that the district court needs to have that gatekeeper function, and in this case it's been met. As to articulating a...
Mr. Coffin, on that point, why don't you walk us through how that's been met?
How that has been met in this
by
case?
By your client.
Oh, my client has put forth facts as the relationship between the parties being one of trust and confidence, although for the Judge Denton said it does not rise to a fiduciary relationship. It's the question of fact is whether or not Gary Tharaldson was entitled to rely upon the representations and the misrepresentations by omissions that Brad Scott and Scott Financial made in this case. And another important fact, well, Scott Financial is...
Do you have any specific omissions you wish to point out to this court as to why we should consider them?
Certainly.
So that this is not just boilerplate that you're throwing out to jump that hurdle.
All right. I'll raise one that I think is the most important. My client guaranteed roughly $100 million worth of loan value in this case based upon representations and documents prepared by Scott and Scott Financial that indicated and provided by Gemstone, another defendant in this case, and Mr. Edelstein, that indicated that this project was sufficiently pre-sold where his guarantees were likely not to be of issue. And so with that basis, that factual basis, he signed his name to $1 million of liability. Now, it turns out that, and this is one fact, it turns out that those representations to pre-sales were materially false in the sense that they were either to Mr. Edelstein's own interest or to a large part to his own father. And certainly no reasonably prudent businessman who had those facts in front of them would have likely executed a $100 million plus dollar guarantee. I've asked to reserve some time, and I'm into that time, so absent a further question, I'll save for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jones.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. Again, Randall Jones on behalf of Scott Financial and Brad Scott individually. I would also ask this court indulgence. I'd like Mr. Klayman on behalf of Bank of Oklahoma would like to have about 3 minutes at the end of this argument for some comments about Bank of Oklahoma that may be particularly relevant to the bank's position.
Please watch your time, though, so fill out the 3 minutes, please.
I will do my best to make sure I get done
before you get into your prepared remarks, could you comment on the last comments made by Mr. Coffing in terms of this potential omission situation, due diligence or lack thereof?
Justice Douglas, I would love to do that. In fact, that was actually going to be one of the places I was going to start. I don't believe that Mr. Coffing answered the question. What he did say is that he believes that there was an issue, some relationship between these parties that gave rise to this special relationship, which, by the way, has not been decided by Judge Denton. Judge Denton just said, I'm going to let you take that issue to trial. He did specifically say there is no fiduciary relationship as a matter of law with these parties here today, the petitioners. What Mr. Coffing addressed were issues that relate to the guarantee as a whole, which, by the way, this issue of pre-sales is hotly contested. And Judge Denton is fully aware of that issue. That issue was brought up repeatedly in these some 30-odd dispositive motions that involved thousands of pages of exhibits and hundreds of pages of deposition testimony. And they did not go to the very issue addressed in Lowe and all the other cases related to Lowe that Lowe is essentially based on, the Tellum case, the Prima Paint case, the Prudential case, all these cases we talked about in our brief that said, look, you have to look at whether or not the allegation of the fraud goes to the issue of the waiver itself. And I understand that the Tuxedo footnote. We'd have a completely different take on the Tuxedo footnote, obviously, than do the petitioners. It would appear, from my reading of Tuxedo, that Tuxedo was essentially saying, look, you can't just say you have to look if there's no specific reference to fraud as it relates to the particular waiver, whether that be a forum selection clause, an arbitration clause, or a jury waiver, That's not the only issue. That's how I read Tuxedo. Tuxedo said we're not going to have a bright line test. What we're going to do is look at the intent of the parties. We have to look beyond necessarily just the argument. And I want to talk about something as a prefatory statement. We're here on a writ. That's extraordinary relief. Obviously, we all know that. And this court has repeatedly held that on a writ of mandamus, and the standard of review, arbitrary and capricious exercise of discretion, or the manifest abuse of discretion standard. I'm citing there Stevens Media versus 8th Judicial District Court. And the court in the City Council of Reno case said, quote, when considering a writ of mandamus, we generally apply a manifest abuse of discretion standard, end quote. A manifest abuse of discretion occurs when the court's action is groundless, arbitrary, or capricious. So that's the standard that presumably you all will take into account when you decide this issue. So let's go back and talk about some uncontested history. What did Judge Denton do, the trial judge in this case, the person most familiar from a judicial standpoint with what happened here? In August of 2009, the respondents filed a motion to strike the jury demand. Relatively early on in this case, Judge Denton said, no, we have not done discovery. I'm not convinced that there won't be some evidence here that would indicate that this jury waiver was inappropriate. So Judge Denton exercised his discretion in denying without prejudice that motion. And we being the respondents, and took depositions, as Mr. Coffin, you already admitted, over a million pages of documents were produced in this case. Mr. Therelson himself, the guarantor, had his deposition taken, I think, for 7 days. We went through in excruciating detail his complaint, probably more detail than in my career. It was a 56-page complaint loaded up with factual allegations, which we believe, and our argument was, it was a preemptive strike filed by the guarantor the 2 days after he got the news, after months of negotiations, that they could not reach an accord, and he was going to get sued. And then 2 days later, he files a 56-page complaint that everyone knows you're never going to get summary judgment on because it's too full of factual allegations. So what happens? They do not allege in that complaint that the specific jury waiver was acquired by fraud. They don't do that. They certainly knew that was an issue on our mind when we filed our motion in August of 2009 to strike that provision. Yet they never amended their complaint to say that jury waiver was acquired by fraud until after extensive briefing and motions and oral argument before Judge Denton and Judge Denton's ruling determining that that jury waiver was not acquired by fraud. That motion occurred well after all discovery was completed, after 15 months of discovery. In January of 2011, we brought a new motion to strike the jury waivers. And only after extensive argument by counsel, these counsel right here, did Judge Denton look at that guarantee. And if I may, just for purposes of my discussion, refer the court to the guarantee. This addresses another question I believe raised by Justice Pickering about North Dakota law. You'll note that, I don't know if you'll be able to note that or not. It's my eyes at this point from the bench might have a hard time noting it. But the top paragraph, paragraph 12, is a venue and choice of law provision. It says Nevada law. As to this guarantee, the Bank of Oklahoma guarantee says North Dakota law. But this guarantee says Nevada law. Right below that, paragraph 13. That paragraph 13, waiver of jury trial, is right above the signature, which is a specific point acknowledged and referenced by Judge Denton as part of his ruling on this issue after all this discovery has been done. That waiver, if you look at it and read it, it addresses every one of the low issues, whether the guarantee was done knowingly, voluntarily, and I'm sure I'm going to forget the law, intentionally. So that guarantee addresses all of those issues. The guarantor's choice, knowingly and voluntarily, and for the mutual benefit of the lender and guarantor. That guarantee
this court should be aware, resulted in a payment of $5 million to Mr. Thorelson personally. Now, you should know, it's important, and this is essentially cannot be contested. The record is replete with the fact that Mr. Thorelson was the mastermind of this relationship and this whole project, this whole deal. Mr. Thorelson, the evidence showed, had already made over $20 million net profit in the prior deal, which was structured virtually identically to this deal in terms of his loan capacity with through one of his entities and his guarantee. The same exact language was contained in that guarantee. The difference, so this court knows, between that case and this case, is Mr. Thorelson made $20 million net profit. Certainly no reason to sue on that basis. As opposed to in this case, which occurred after the meltdown of our entire national economy, not to mention the severity of it here in Las Vegas. That's the distinguishing factor. The point is, as Judge Denton specifically found, and this is in the record, this is actually petitioner's appendix at 819, quote, the court determined that the conspicuous uppercase jury waivers just above the signature lines for use by the obviously sophisticated Mr. Thorelson are valid and enforceable as to all issues surrounding the validity and enforceability of the guarantees, end quote, citing, Low Enterprises Residential Partners.
Could now, you, I don't mean to derail your argument, but I'm concerned about time. The issue that's of interest to me particularly is the Dairy Queen Beacon Theaters issue, and I know you take a lot of comfort from the Awada case, but I don't see reference to those decisions in that opinion, though you did raise them in the briefs. And my concern is, to what extent are these issues intertwined such that proceeding with a non-jury trial first, as is currently structured, is going to diminish the jury trial right as to the remaining claims for Mr. Coffin's client? Long question, but I want to understand your position on that.
Justice Pickering, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I could probably talk all day about this subject, but there are certain critical issues, and I'm glad you raised that. I initially took very little comfort in the Awada case because, ironically, I was on the other side of that case. So we lost that appeal, and we raised Beacon Theater and Dairy Queen to this court in that case. And the Supreme Court said no. In fact, the Supreme Court didn't even refer to the Beacon Theater or Dairy Queen cases in the decision in Awada. That's how little the bench at that time took that into account in its concern.
And as far as I can tell, we have never either endorsed or affirmatively repudiated those cases, though they're Eisenhower era.
Even though they are Eisenhower era. But to address your case specific, or your point specifically, Justice Pickering, I would refer you to the petitioner's appendix, again, at 819, having to do with the bifurcation order. This is Judge Denton's language. I'm quoting, quote, by bringing this action, the guarantor plaintiffs can hardly complain that the court would attend to the guarantee issues first. The court will thus try the guarantee issues first in a bench trial. In making this decision, the court notes that confusion and prejudice can best be avoided by such a bifurcation, and it believes that issues will likely be narrowed with concomitant judicial economy, end quote, Awada. Your Honor, Judge Denton is in the best position, obviously, as the trial judge, to assess judicial economy. He clearly did not abuse his discretion. He did not act arbitrarily and capriciously. He took into account this very issue. And so you're aware, there was lengthy discussion at these motions. Judge Denton gave us, we argued for more than 2 hours, these motions. Heavily briefed with multiple exhibits. That issue was heavily discussed at the argument as to what that would mean. And Judge Denton, in his discretion, decided that it would be most appropriate, and that in fact, so you all know, it may obviate the need to even have Club Vista pursue this claim, because Club Vista is a beneficiary of these guarantees. And if we prevail on the guarantees, then Club Vista may not have any damages. So Judge Denton took all of these factors into account when he decided whether or not to bifurcate it in the way he did. And this court has said in Awada, which I think is consistent with the majority opinions in the country since the Eisenhower era, that a district court should be allowed great discretion with respect to how they control the trial that occurs in their courtroom, because they're by far in the best position to determine the manner in which the case should be tried in all fairness. So the court, it seems to me, has to ask itself the question, this court, whether or not that was a manifest abuse of Judge Denton's discretion such that it was arbitrary and capricious. I think the facts of this case speak for themselves to demonstrate that clearly that was not true because of not just the order itself, but all of the attendant arguments that were made and briefs that were filed in connection with that very issue.
One follow-up question, and I hope Justice Sata will give the other minute. Would you concede that if this case were in federal court and Dairy Queen and Beacon Theaters applied directly without WADA, that the order of trial would have to be reversed? The jury trial would have to go first and the court trial second?
I don't know that I could concede that. I will tell you my candid answer is that I don't have enough knowledge to know of the current state of federal law, because I didn't really look at that issue. I know Beacon Theater is still out there and Dairy Queen are still out there, but I haven't really looked at what would happen in a federal case currently. That may be the case, I just can't say honestly.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Justice Sata.
Certainly. We have 1 minute of time to the remaining time. Counsel?
So I can come up and say a few words. Thank you.
I greatly appreciate this opportunity. I know the court's read everything. I just want to emphasize, Bank of Oklahoma was the last party in this. We took over a $24 out of a $25 million commitment that Club Vista had in this loan relationship. And in return for that, we received as additional consideration this TM2 guarantee. The TM2 guarantee was critical, and it was drafted by the attorneys that Mr. Thoroldson is now suing in two different courts in Minnesota and Arizona. So he had his own counsel, who he contends has committed malpractice, draft this TM2 guarantee. He was not only a sophisticated businessman, but he, by his own allegations in his own complaint, was represented by counsel. So, and this waiver, which was, this is almost identical to the language that we had in the TM2 guarantee, should be enforceable. It is something that he readily agreed to, and to be belatedly saying he didn't appreciate the act is regrettable, and we shouldn't be here. When we were sued on this, we were surprised and thought that this should have been in North Dakota. We raised that with Judge Denton, and Judge Denton exercised his discretion and kept the case here. Even though Mr. Thoroldson agreed to the exclusive jurisdiction of the TM2 guarantee in North Dakota, in the North Dakota courts, here we are in a Nevada court where he is now trying to avoid this particular guarantee and the enforceability of the waiver of jury trial. We pointed out to you two cases that address the jury trial waiver issue, the First State Bank of Rockford, which generally says the party can waive contractual rights absent some public policy or express provision in a statute. And most pertinently, the County 20 storage case, a federal case, that clearly says the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial can be waived. And I thought the language used by the court was particularly appropriate. Said a party may contractually waive its Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial. The waiver must be made knowing and voluntarily. And clearly, Judge Denton found that in his decision below after extensive arguments. And finally, I note, courts have considered whether the waiver provision is on a standardized form, agreement, or newly drafted document. This was a document drafted by Mr. Thoroldson's counsel in fine print or in large or bold print. And this is large print and bold. And I just think when you see the language and the fact that Judge Denton found that we did not defraud Mr. Thoroldson, whatever allegations there are, we specifically refuted it in summary judgment. We're simply in the position of a lender and a debtor with no special obligations. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. colleagues.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Coffin.
Briefly. In reference to Justice Pickering, your earlier question, my counsel pointed out to me appropriately that as a standard that prevents, you know, a rush of every claim being subject to fraud, we have the heightened pleading standards under Rule 9. And those pleading standards have been tested time and time again here. And so the court does have a role as a gatekeeper already and can clearly keep a general claim of fraud from invalidating every contract. As to the basis for this court's decision, it's clear that this is a legal issue that the court considered a novo. And in fact, in the Lowe decision, this court noted that clearly the validity of contractual jury waivers is an important issue of Nevada law that needs clarification and public policy would be served by invocation of original justice. And so I think that's the standard that this court should be looking towards rather than this arbitrary and abuse of discretion standard, because it's not a factual finding that the court has made as of yet. And Justice Douglas, you asked Mr. Jones a question, and I'm not sure that he answered it, in that the triggering event for Mr. Tharaldson in executing these guarantees and the loan documents was the pre-sales. And he's right. These are hotly contested issues that are going to be tried, and it's what form they are going to be tried that should be paramount of this court's concern. And that's why I appreciate the reference to Beacon and Dairy Queen, because I believe that if we were in federal court, that the issues would be tried to a jury before they would be tried to a judge. And so I think that is an important distinction in those cases. And finally, as to Mr. Klayman's reliance.
Do you think that AWADA rejects that, though? I mean, how could you square AWADA with us going back and saying, oh, Beacon Theaters and Dairy Queen are right? It's a quandary.
Well, I think it is, and that's why I suggest that to the extent this court is willing to reconsider its jurisprudence as it relates to AWADA, as referenced, we believe, in Tuxedo and Rosenberg, that it should be, because then there would be uniformity enforcement, whether we're in a state court or a federal court. And so to the extent that that modifies, I think that that's appropriate. As to the North Dakota arguments and Mr. Klayman's, I think it's important to note, despite his reliance on County 20, County 20 versus Wells Fargo invalidated the jury provision, despite language very much like the language you see here, albeit it was not above the signature line, it was contained within a complex interest rate swap document. That same language persisted. So I think I do not think that this court can say with any level of certainty that North Dakota's longstanding invocation of their constitutional right to trial by jury has been in any way invalidated by County 20 or the First Bank language that was cited to this court. Your Honor, what we're looking for here, this court, we're looking for a fair shake on our claims that deserve to be had to be heard by a jury. And what I haven't heard is any claim of prejudice. Whether or not these claims are tried to a jury of my client's fundamental constitutional right versus perhaps some additional burden at the expense of a jury trial versus a bench trial. And with those 50 depositions, millions of pages of documents, and I dare say millions of dollars worth of fees, at this point to have a claim of prejudice, although I didn't hear one today, is really disingenuous. My client's looking for the opportunity to have his case and this issue heard by a jury of his peers, and he should be allowed that right.
Mr. Coffin, you, at the outset, you talked about a stack of documents were presented to your client. He signed off.
Right.
Mr. Klayman's mentioned the fact that your client's attorneys were involved in drafting of the guarantee. I guess the question inherent in that is, did they take a look at this rough contract before your client ever got it?
And Justice Douglas, I am glad, and I wanted to express how glad I am that Mr. Klayman is candid now in saying that the Maslin law firm was our law firm, because I can tell you in the other cases that he referenced, the Maslin law firm is hotly contending that there are Brad Scott and Scott Financial's attorneys and owed no duties to Mr. Tharaldson. So to the extent that the Maslin firm reviewed these documents, who their master was is the subject of two lawsuits at this point in time. So, but I cannot disagree with you that the documents were created by a Minnesota attorney and presented to either Brad Scott or Scott Financial.
And I guess a direct part of my question still is, was Mr. Tharaldson represented by counsel during these negotiations?
He believed that he was represented by Brad Scott and the Maslin Law Firm. That is his belief.
And that was the only parties that were representing him?
At that time, yes, Your Honor.
Questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Cochran.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your arguments here today. This matter will stand submitted.